Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Full interview archives are at scotthorton.org. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. And et cetera like that. Follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. All right, good times. Now we got Will Grigg on the line. He keeps a blog. It's really, you know, a collection of great articles. It's called Pro Libertate. It's at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. He's also the author of the book Liberty in Eclipse, which you can also get in audio book. And you can read him quite often at the blog and on the front page at lourockwell.com as well. Welcome back to the show, Will. How are you doing?
Scott, I'm doing great. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Good times. Very happy to have you here. And now, for those who aren't familiar, Will is among the, he may well be, you rank him yourself, but there are very few, and he's among the very best critics of the American police state, and especially focusing on the local and state police, the drug task forces, and the corruption at the deputy sheriff level, the brutality against every man that, you know, it's part of your local newscast from time to time, but doesn't always seem to make national news. But anyway, Will is holding it down on keeping track of all of this news. And, well, and if Shame was a flamethrower, he'd be blowing away these bastards who are committing these crimes, hiding behind these badges. But anyway, so please go and read him. Bookmark him. He's your new favorite. And just wait till he starts talking here in a second. You're going to know what I mean. He writes as well as he speaks. Even better, maybe. And so, again, it's freedominourtime.blogspot.com. And only say that because I want to be free. Yes, I like Will, but I honestly believe if everybody reads Will Grigg's blog, then I'll live in a freer country, and that would be better. So, it's a
selfish
thing.
Scott, you do me an immense and largely undeserved honor. Thank you.
Yeah, well. All right. High Desert Highwaymen. More scenes from the drug war in Treasure Valley. Where's Treasure Valley? Is that... Was it already called that before the cops started shaking everybody's pockets upside down, or what?
Well, the provenance of that name has something to do with an honorable effort to improve one's life through the exertion of one's industry and mixing one's industry with the soil. There were people who settled here peacefully and had peaceful relations with the local Indians. They helped themselves to resources on an equitable and mutually beneficial basis with the local Indians, and then government got involved. So that's the backdrop to the area of Idaho and Oregon called the Treasure Valley. It's an area that encompasses Malheur County on the Oregon side and Washington, Payette, and Canyon County on the Idaho side, and I live right in the middle of it. And the High Desert Drug Enforcement Task Force is one of these multilateral, federally funded narcotics Soviets, if you will, that have proliferated across the countryside in recent decades. And their growth was abetted dramatically back in 2009 when, as part of the stimulus package, the Obama administration pumped out the better part of $1 billion for the Byrne Memorial Grant Program, which is the chief conduit of funding for federalizing local law enforcement. And one of the reasons I focus obsessively, according to my critics, on the issue of local law enforcement is because that is the retail-level tyranny that we confront. It's no longer abstract when you're dealing with something that's happening literally in your own cities and neighborhoods. And in this case, we're literally talking about my own neighborhood and my own county and city and the stomping grounds in which my misspent youth was spent, if you will. I grew up in Vail, Oregon, which is the seat of Malheur County, which is the size of some states in the eastern seaboard region. And this High Desert Drug Enforcement Task Force has been routinely waylaying people on I-84, which is one of the main arteries of traffic, one of the north-south and east-west arteries of traffic, running from Washington to the interior of the country. And many of your listeners are probably acquainted with the case of Darian Rosine. He's a retired real estate executive who lives in Colorado and has a second residence in Washington. Those are two states that have embraced something akin to reason on the issue of marijuana prohibition. They're trying, however, gingerly to decriminalize the recreational use of that substance. He was waylaid on I-84, just a few miles from where I'm sitting right now, as a matter of fact, by a state trooper for the Idaho State Patrol by the name of Justin Klitsch. And Justin Klitsch, once he had stopped this man, he's about 70 years old, the victim of this seizure, at a rest stop next to I-84. Within a couple of minutes, he started playing the game that this man obviously must be considered a drug smuggler because of his Colorado license plates, because he was heading down from Washington, basically, I-84 that eventually terminates in Washington. And a few minutes into this conversation, and it was a pretext stop, a pure pretext stop, Klitsch browbeat this man into opening his trunk, which is something you should never do. The instant the trunk was open, Klitsch said, "Oh, I smell marijuana, now I get to search your entire vehicle." And a six-hour-long ordeal ensued, where this man's property, most of it consisting of baby shower gifts, was taken out and mutilated at the Sallyport to the Payette County Sheriff's Office, which is about 5 miles from where I'm sitting here in the town of Payette. There was nothing to this stop that was in any sense constitutional, but it's entirely representative of what some elements of this task force do. And Mr. Klitsch is an individual of some very bad reputation locally because of the fact that he routinely conducts pretext stops that grow into searches. And his chief occupation now is to stop people coming out of Oregon, because Oregon has authorized the use of medical marijuana for people who have identifiable, documentable, qualifying healthcare situations. And so because medical marijuana is legal in Oregon, and this is a border town, they do a very brisk business in confiscation of marijuana from people in Idaho who get it for qualifying conditions. There had been a medical marijuana facility called the 45th Parallel that was in operation for a couple of years, but it was shut down during a raid in September 2012 in which the High Desert Task Force was involved. And this was arranged by a rogue DEA agent, or do I repeat myself, by the name of Hankins. Well, he called himself Hankins, but his actual name was Dustin Bloxham. His cover name was Dustin Hankins. And he conducted this operation without the authorization of the U.S. Attorney for Idaho, Wendy Olson, who's not at all reticent about throwing her weight around. And this is outside the jurisdiction to which it had been assigned. But he committed wire fraud by calling this clinic in Ontario, Oregon, which is another state, misrepresenting his circumstances, and then suborning a doctor into falsifying a medical record claiming that he had a work-related injury that was the source of chronic pain that was inoperable. And using this falsified medical record, he went to this clinic, and the clinic personnel, carrying out all of the detailed regulations of the medical marijuana program in Oregon, got him a medical marijuana card, provided him with a small amount of marijuana, and that began the process of taking down this clinic. And the reason why Mr. Bloxham wanted to take it down, as I document in an email that I provided a link to in my article about this subject, is the fact that he suspected that they were making a lot of money. In other words, there's cash to be had. We have the means to seize that cash, those assets, through asset forfeiture, so we need to run an operation in collaboration with the Malheur County Sheriff's Office in Vail, a detective by the name of Brad Williams. And they ended up confiscating all of the marijuana on the premises and all of the money in their bank accounts and all of the marijuana grows at 11 locations. They reeled in the better part of probably a half a ton of marijuana. You're talking about mature marijuana plants that are the size of Christmas trees, and nobody can account for it. That's one of the really interesting things about this story, is that they supposedly buried several hundred pounds of medical marijuana at a dump, a landfill outside of the little town of Vail, Oregon. So I went to the landfill and talked to the manager, and he said, "I think they did, but we don't have a record of it." I went to the solid waste disposal department at the courthouse in Vail, Oregon, and asked them questions. And two very nervous people said, "Well, no, we don't have any record of that. You'll have to talk to the sheriff's office." Well, I already heard from the sheriff's office. Detective Williams had just testified under oath that he had buried the marijuana rather than burning it. The latter mode of operation is what's prescribed by regulations in the law. So there's the better part of a half ton of marijuana that's not accounted for. Uh-huh. One of the people that had been associated with that clinic, who turned state's evidence, was allowed to open up a clinic of her own in Ontario, in spite of the fact there's a moratorium in effect. It's within 1,000 feet of the school. The DEA is not interested in this. The task force isn't interested in this. It looks to me like a payoff, but that's perfectly typical of what happens under a prohibition regime.
All right, back in a sec, y'all, with Will Grigg.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Are you sick of the neocons and the Israel lobby pretending as though they've earned some kind of monopoly on foreign policy wisdom in Washington, D.C.? These peanut clowns who've never been right about anything? Well, the Council for the National Interest is pushing back, telling the lobby to go take a hike. The empire's bad enough without the neocons making it all about the interests of a foreign state. Help CNI promote peace. Visit their site at councilforthenationalinterest.org and click Donate under About Us at the top of the page.
All right, you guys. Welcome back. We got Will Grigg on the line. He writes at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Now, Will, you're telling me that this High Desert Drug Enforcement Task Force is nothing but a gang of thieves and liars and drug dealers hiding behind the color of law. Is that right?
I think that's an apt summary of what I'm saying and what I've been able to document. And what I wish people would understand here is that every time you enforce prohibition of a vice, and a vice, of course, is a self-injurious act that doesn't of necessity hurt others. The latter, of course, would be a crime or a tort, depending upon the circumstances. But any time the government presumes to make us more virtuous by imposing prohibition of a vice, you make criminals out of people who are not injuring people, but you also create a regime in which criminals are enforcing the law. And the most notorious criminals in a prohibition regime are those on the supposedly respectable side of law and order. And in this case, you've got a huge amount of money that was taken from a business that apparently, as far as I can tell, was operating pretty fastidiously within the laws it was understood at the time. The law was very confusing regarding medical marijuana. Attorney General Rosenbaum from Oregon in 2012, which was the year of the great bust there, the 45th Parallel Medical Marijuana Co-op, actually said in public she didn't understand the law, and most of the people enforcing it didn't understand the law. The law has been changed in the interval, and so when Billis Benson and Raymond Kangas were found guilty of providing marijuana for consideration a couple of weeks ago, and this was supposedly part of a racketeering scheme, they were actually found guilty under RICO of operating a racketeering organization. They were prosecuted under dead letter law. That law is no longer in effect, and you cannot demonstrate that they did harm to anybody because they were providing a legally recognized palliative remedy to willing, I guess you call them, business partners in a way that seems to be mutually satisfactory. They were providing a legal product to people who wanted it, and yet the harm here, supposedly, is that the price structure of their co-op was considered unsatisfactory by people who've never operated a business. And this was a business only in the sense that they obviously had to keep a margin in order to keep the lights on and to have storage for the marijuana and things of that sort to provide compensation for growers in a dynamic and somewhat confusing economy here, given the fact that it's still a highly regulated one. But the people who were enforcing this measure made out like proverbial bandits, because the chief prosecutor here in Malheur County, Deputy District Attorney Michael T. Dugan, submitted a sentencing memorandum calling for $40,000, give or take a few dollars, in compensation for himself personally to be taken directly out of the proceeds that were seized from the 45th Parallel. The Malheur County Sheriff's Office has gotten at least $40,000 in asset forfeiture proceeds, as well as the better part of $100,000 in fines that are being paid directly to the Sheriff's Office by the 16 other defendants here, none of whom face prison sentences. They all cooperated. They all took plea deals. They all took probation, including the one I mentioned just before the break, who actually has a record of manufacturing and delivering methamphetamine, and she's operating a medical marijuana facility now in Ontario, Oregon, despite the fact that there's now a moratorium in effect. And this is something which was known. It was stated in open court that this woman, Trisha Gardner, with a background that disqualified her from being involved in medical marijuana, was operating what has to be considered an illegal facility. The DEA is aware of it. Detective Williams, who is the chief investigator of the 45th Parallel, was aware of it. She filed the paperwork the day before the raid, on September 11, 2012. September 10th, she filed the paperwork with the Secretary of State in Oregon to open up her own facility, and she followed to the letter the same business model that had been used by the 45th Parallel. And while she was preparing for trial on the charges relating to the 45th Parallel, there were two charges quietly dropped against her for check forging, and the amount of hundreds and hundreds of dollars. They were dispensed so that she could be a featured witness against Bill Isbenson, who was identified as the ringleader of the operation. But these people, Mr. Isbenson and Mr. Kangas, are people of modest means. Mr. Isbenson had one conviction, one drug-related conviction from a quarter century ago in his background. Raymond Kangas had no criminal convictions, no criminal charges in his background at all whatsoever, but they were depicted in court as if they were Al Capone. And the thing is, if you take a look at the people who are actually using violence and fraud in order to steal huge amounts of money, you'd have to say that the High Desert Task Force and the county prosecutor's office in Malheur County meet that description, but it's always that way under a prohibitionist regime. The other thing I want to mention here, Scott, is that before the trial even began, they had already forfeited a huge amount of money from the bank account of Mr. Isbenson to fund the prosecution against him, which means they'd already imposed the punishment, they'd already confiscated the money from him that they were used to prosecute him before he'd been found guilty of committing a crime. And again, that's the type of distortion in due process that's very much a part of the ongoing war on drugs.
Yeah. Oh, the whole thing is just amazing to read. Again, the website is freedominourtime.blogspot.com. And, you know, it's the kind of thing where all you got to do is just take one look at it. It could have been you or any other journalist.
Yeah.
Take one look at it. It's so obvious what's going on there.
But that's an interesting point, Scott. I had a conversation yesterday with somebody who's involved sort of peripherally in the criminal justice system here in Treasure Valley. And this individual doesn't have an excessively exalted opinion of law enforcement because she deals with them all the time, and that, of course, will disabuse you of any notion that we're dealing with paladins of public order. But I said in a moment of frustration, there are probably two dozen people who are legitimate professional journalists here in this part of the Treasure Valley. They write for local newspapers. We have radio stations, television stations. This stuff is easily accessible through the public record, or if you simply want to sit through 6 or 8 hours of court hearings the way I did, you can actually collect the facts and write a story. Why would anybody else publish a syllable about this or say a syllable about it on radio or television? And she said, well, obviously they need to have somebody from outside the area come and report stories of this kind because there are professional consequences mm-hmm. for people who discomfort the ambitions of mm-hmm. those who occupy positions of power and privilege. And I said, well, of course, you know, the luxury of my position is they can't fire me. You know, being a freelancer, which is, of course, a rather exalted way of saying
well,
listen, unemployed.
I didn't mean to play down your
fired.
Talent either. I just meant that these guys' scam is so clear that, you know, come on, how could they be getting away with this at all?
Well, they get away with it through brazenness on their part and through, I think, bullied acquiescence on the part of people who otherwise would be trying to hold them accountable. I should point out that there's a very talented attorney, defense attorney from Ontario by the name of Susan Gerber, who had been part of the state attorney general's office, and she left the dark side, became a Jedi rather than a Sith a few years ago. And they're trying to run her out of the state. During the course of this trial, and this has been going on, the pretrial and the trial, for about 2 years, the powers that be have filed four bar complaints against her for reasons that will withstand even trivial or superficial examination. And it's obvious, as she said, they're trying to tie her up and they're trying to get her bar license pulled and they're trying to drive her out of business precisely because she's being a conscientious advocate, not only for the people who are accused in this case, but also for a number of itinerant workers of Mexican ancestry here who are being processed through the system without being Mirandized. There's a huge story that needs to be written about that. There's an assembly line here of taking people out of the fields and basically putting them through a legal process they'd understand, and they skip the part where they're told that they have certain rights, certain immunities, certain privileges of non-disclosure and non-self-incrimination. This is all being systematically ignored, and they're simply being monetized. And that's the whole process that we're talking about, Scott. They monetize the misery of marginal people. This has nothing to do with the protection of life, liberty, and property. This is a way of enriching people who found themselves in these positions and who opportunistically examine the conduct of others in search of prosecutable offenses that don't actually involve real crimes. And that, I think, summarizes the way the criminal justice system works everywhere, not just this obscure corner of rural Oregon or rural western Idaho. This is the sort of thing, I think, from which we can extrapolate the condition of the entire criminal justice system and the American Soyuz.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, speaking of which, there's this one more story here. We have almost no time to discuss it, really, but You have this piece here about the former Attorney General of Idaho, Mark Shurtleff, who became the victim of a SWAT raid, and now all of a sudden, oh, boo-hoo for him, and yet no self-awareness apparently on his part about, you know, geez, I wonder how many men under my authority kicked down people's doors and terrorized their families in this very same way.
Yeah, that's Mark Shurtleff. He's the former Attorney General of Utah, and he was in Washington doing what former attorneys general do. He was cashing in on his position when his home was raided and his two teenage kids were terrorized by a multi-jurisdictional SWAT team that included the FBI. His 17-year-old daughter was in the bathroom. She was dragged out with her chest being painted by laser sights. And Shurtleff said, this is horrible. This is Gestapo tactics. Well, exactly. He had once been the hammer, and now he's the nail, and he finds the ladder roll to be thoroughly disagreeable.
Right. Yeah, and you know, the thing is, it shouldn't be that complicated, even for these meathead, you know, cops. I don't know. That's the worst thing I can call them. Even to them, they got to be able to think for just a second about, what, the wives, the kids, the cousins of the people that they're after, even if the people that they're after are scumbags or whatever they, you know, call them to dehumanize them and go after them. What about all the collateral damage? These are supposedly our same townsfolk and stuff, right? It's not like they're literally an occupying army and we're the Hajis, you know, and they're patrolling our sector out in some conquered land. They're supposed to be, there's got to be some dissonance here. They know that they're supposedly our security force. And yet, you know, they come for you. They slam your wife against the wall. They put their German machine gun in your child's face. What the hell is this? How do they justify that at all? There's not even more money in it for doing it that way. But what's the fun in that, beating up people's wives and kids, you know?
I think it appeals to the prurient interests of people who've surrendered themselves to their baser impulses, and you'd think that people would be burdened with enough moral imagination to understand that if you're going to kick in the door of a home at 3 in the morning and hurl a flashbang grenade into the living area, something bad's going to happen, as happened in Habersham County, Georgia, just a few weeks ago, when this 18-month-old baby was severely burned in his crib, being left with disfiguring scars on his face, problems with sight and hearing, a big gaping hole in his chest where his rib cage had been exposed. And this was over a nonviolent offense involving a trivial amount of drugs allegedly sold to a paid undercover informant who's probably a career criminal looking for a downward departure. And no drugs were found during this raid. You've got to figure, if you're somebody who chromosomally or conceptually is an American in any sense, that it's wrong to be kicking indoors at 3 in the morning. That's something that should strike even your proverbial meathead lummox as self-evident, I would think. But there has been, for the last couple of decades, this systematic effort to indoctrinate people in law enforcement into the belief that they are indeed part of what could be described as an army of occupation, and that the public is this roiling, undifferentiated mass of menace, and that officer safety is the highest consideration. And so they have been taught to look upon us as being something radically other from themselves, which is one of the reasons why I tweak that conceit consistently by referring to the public as mundanes, to distinguish the rest of us from the exalted brotherhood of officially sanctioned coercion. And I think what's happened is that over the last few years, finally the public's starting to tumble to the fact that we are not being made safer by what's happening in the law enforcement community, as it styles itself, and that they look upon us as the enemy. And unfortunately, what's happening now that the public is waking up is that many, many people in law enforcement are sort of reverting to their tribalist identity here, and it's reinforcing their sense of being besieged and being the subject of the malevolent intentions of people they've been trained to look upon as insurgents. So I think things are actually going to get uglier in the near term before hopefully they get better when the money runs out and the federal government can no longer keep subsidizing these task forces. That would really do a great deal, I think, toward helping our circumstances.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you're certainly right there about, you know, people waking up and seeing that it's really the exact other way around, that they're the undifferentiated threat against peace and security around here. It's us regular people who do all the making of things and you know, create all the harmony in society. They're the ones who are the obstruction. As more people get that just, as you're saying, from their point of view, it just proves them right. The more contempt we have for them, the more proof it is that we're all just a bunch of criminals. I remember on Cops 25 years ago or something, Will, a cop, one of the cops on the show Cops, he said, there's only two kinds of people in this world, suspects and victims.
Yeah.
That was it. And, that was every, and the victims are the cops, so the suspects
is everybody else. Which is he. Or that line from Blade Runner, if you're not a cop, you're little people.
Yep. Yeah, and they're coming for your ass, and no rights for you. Yeah, now you're not even a suspect. Now you're an enemy.
Exactly.
Yep. All right, well, thanks again. You're scaring the hell out of me, as always, but you're doing great journalism there, Will, and sure hope people look at it.
I really appreciate this, Scott. You take care.
You too. All right, y'all, that's the great Will Grigg. He's at Pro Libertate, freedominourtime.blogspot.com, freedominourtime.blogspot.com, and the book is Liberty in Eclipse, and I think I have now officially blown every break of all three interviews today. We're way over time, but that's it, so goodbye. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org. Nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. offnow.org. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.